Today's podcast is brought to you by Tetra Hearing. Tetra Hearing isn't just hearing protection, it's hearing perfection.
You guys seen many specs around?
Yeah, they showed up.
Already?
Started seeing them yesterday at our place.
Snows?
No.
No well, snows? There's like 800 snows that stayed in the valley.
Okay, I heard that was a rumor.
No.
Partially true.
No.
And then somebody's
huge, right?
Zach, Delavan,
and
they even went down to the grasslands.
What's the thought on that? Sick and didn't fly or wanted to stick around?
They collared a lot of them.
Oh, really? Really? Yeah.
Transmitters, but they tested the ones they caught and they all had antibodies for high path AI. So,
any of them nest here?
No.
No.
They'll have like brain lesions and stuff.
Really?
I flushed a speck out of a field one time while nest dragging, and I was like, "Oh, first speck nest."
A speck out of a field?
Yeah, it was one of the RCPP fields. It was up there, really? That weird one up there on the west side of 5, up by SAC Refuge.
Yep, yep.
And no nest, but there were some specks using like the freshly flooded rice to the north, and we flushed a single out of the field, and I was like, "Oh, here we go!" And then nothing.
So if you shoot a collared snow. Make sure it wasn't.
Well, they didn't call. They didn't collar. I don't think they collared any of the AI ones. They just caught them and banded them.
Oh, I thought they collared some of them just because.
I mean,
maybe
I don't think so. Just because, maybe they did, but I mean like one or two.
Yeah.
Just because it's like they're gonna die.
Where'd they fall the water around? Because isn't everything dry up pretty much?
No, Sachs got a couple good summer water units. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Are they flying around? Like,
yeah.
That's so.
They said they're in terrible body condition. They're just like scrawny and.
Yeah, there was like 50 on YOLO most of the summer.
It'll be interesting to see if they make a comeback now. You know, stuff's starting to get harvested and they bounce out and start hitting rice. And
all of a sudden,
somebody's going to shoot one of those birds in Canada in 3 years and be like, oh.
But it's like grown. The first year, like I think 3 years ago was the first time they saw it. And there was like 80 or 100 on SAC. Yeah. And then it went to like almost 400. And then this year it's like almost 1,000.
But it's not.
That's a lot.
Like,
But it's not a habitual thing. It's they're being forced to because they can't make the trip back.
That's what they're thinking. That's what we think.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So
until they show up on all the golf courses.
Can you imagine?
Yeah.
No.
It'd be wild.
That would
but be they're wild. Colonial nesters. So it's not like honkers where they're going to do like onesie twosie.
Yeah.
So it's like where would they set that up? You know,
SAC Refuge,
and who would let them do that? Like, you know,
they'd let them do it at SAC. I'm sure.
You think?
Oh yeah, they would just. I mean, I can't see them like purposely destroying
putting a stop to it.
Yeah.
Well, it'd be interesting to see if they all get healthy, and then 1 year there's just nothing again.
Right.
They all migrate out.
Yeah.
Because, like you said, there's been more and more every year, but is it due to
Right. Are we establishing a new pattern,
yeah,
or is it just
that'd be
like
crazy?
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty well.
There's got to be. Imagine a few specks, too, that people just don't notice that stick around like that.
Well, down in the Delta.
I was going to say, people claim in the Delta more and more sticking around.
Yeah, there's like a group that have hung out, and you'll see them like boating around in the summer. They'll be flying around. Yeah,
I've never seen that.
But yeah, you never know. Never know.
Strange.
Cool. Well, we have Luke Matthews with CDFW. He's the Nesting Bird Habitat Incentive Program Coordinator. Woo, mouthful. NBHIP coordinator for short. And then we have Jason Koslovich, CWA biologist, and Carson Odegaard, our normal co-host. But we're going to be talking about the nesting bird program and what that's doing here in California and kind of where it's going. So, Luke, appreciate you coming in and talking to us.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Yes, tell us a little bit about yourself and kind of your background and how you got here.
Sure. Yeah, I have a little bit of an unconventional path to this field. I started out of high school, worked in the trades. I was working in refineries and stuff, did that for like 4 or 5 years, decided I didn't like it anymore. And so wanted to go back to school. I went to a junior college at night and then ended up transferring to Davis. Got my undergrad there in wildlife, fish and conservation biology, and then did my master's with Edie. Doing waste grain, food availability, and rice and corn for the Central Valley for waterfowl. So did that and then finished that up in 2018, got hired by the Rice Commission. I was their wildlife programs manager for 4 years. Fantastic job. Loved it. And then this program was created and they had the position open. I applied for it and got that job about 2 years ago. So that's sort of the quick and dirty of how I got here.
Nice. Now, with the Rice Commission, what exactly were you doing there? Like administering grants or waterfowl stuff? I know you'd worked with Jason a lot prior.
Yeah, so I was the wildlife programs manager, was the position, and basically just working on all things wildlife. So I was the wildlife biologist on staff, and just focused on implementing incentive programs. So we would get grants from NRCS, like the RCPP, and we had a contract with Jason and CWA to help us do some of the monitoring, doing a lot of shorebird stuff, a lot of waterfowl stuff, mostly focused on winter flooding habitat. And we implemented the program for the Department of Fish and Wildlife, the California Winter Rice Habitat Incentive Program. Yeah. And all of this is still going on. They refilled the position with Kristen Sesser, who's the new biologist over there.
Awesome. All right on. Tell us a little bit about this Nesting Bird Habitat Incentive Program.
Yeah, so I mean, I don't know how much you want to know, and
all
you know,
of it,
all of it. Okay,
fine details.
All right. Well, so the program was created back in 2018 through legislation, and it was really created to help address the alarming trends of declining mallards, largely in California, as well as gadwall and pheasant. You know, our local breeding birds here. And when it was created back then, there was no funding associated with it. CWA and a lot of people helped, you know, with getting that across the line. So it was established in Fish and Game Code. The program was there, but because there was no money, nothing happened. And so it just sort of sat there until 2021 when they passed another bill that created the funding source for it. And that was the additional stamp fees for your California duck validation and your upland game validation. And that came into effect 2022. And so folks would be, you know, when they noticed a $10 hike on each of those stamps, yeah, that's what that was for.
Going all directly to Nesting.
100% of it goes to this program. And it's for just trying to, I mean, broad strokes, trying to reverse the trends of declining, you know, waterfowl and pheasant population. So pays my salary, pays for all the incentives, pays for the research and monitoring, the contracts we got with USGS and CWA and stuff.
And how has the landscape changed from when we've had those, you know, record numbers of pheasants and mallards to where we are now? I mean, can you put that into scope of what hunters saw 30 years ago to what they're kind of seeing now in the landscape and the habitat of where we're at?
I'd say it's hard to pinpoint a single thing. You know, we've seen a lot of landscape level changes. You know, but one thing that we saw in the late 90s, and I'm young, so I don't, when I say we saw, I'm reading about the data and talking.
Rumor is,
exactly. But, you know, there was a ton of set aside in ag, multi-year set aside through farm bill programs. And so you were seeing tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of acres on the landscape that were fallow for multi-year and tons of vegetation there. And that coincided with some of the peak numbers we're seeing in waterfowl and pheasants. And then, you know, you sort of saw that shift away from that, less cereal grains being planted in the valley, less of these set asides, more clean farming, more trees. Mm-hmm. And so all of these are just sort of things that grassland nesting birds, you know, don't like, right? So you're sort of seeing a reduction of habitat, and a reduction of water in the summer on the landscape. And so those are really what we think are the primary drivers of decline of our breeding birds.
And in some of the incentive things you guys are doing, are you guys going out and planting native grasses, wheat? I mean, what are some of the projects that you guys are doing and what are you guys doing to help, you know, reverse the trend?
Yeah, so this is just the second year of implementation. So we're starting off slow and trying to build on it. So we will be expanding what we're doing as we continue to implement this program every year. The first year we just did private land incentives with farmers. It was the fallow ag and delayed grain harvest, delayed mm-hmm. wheat harvest. And so that was sort of an easy, those programs were already established. And so just sort of plugging in and running them with CWA. And then this year we added the rice levy program to it. And we're looking to expand it to do incentives on public lands as well. So working with wildlife areas and national wildlife refuges to do native grass restoration, plant cereal grains, things like that. And we hope to expand it to do more of that stuff as well on private land. So native grass restorations, things like that.
Monetary incentives, you're saying, where it's like, hey, if you guys go do X, Y, and Z, we'll provide you with these funds. Is that the incentive part of it?
Yeah. So the way it works, at least right now, is for, say, a farmer, you know, we pay them to largely not do things, right? Because doing things is what destroys the habitat, right? So they'll go in and harvest their cereal grains in May or June, and there's peak nesting. You know, Jason could talk about that for hours. And so we just pay them to delay that until July. Everything we do, what is in Fish and Game Code, is that there can't be disturbance from April 1st to July 15th. So anything that's funded by this program has that bound on it. And so we're asking folks to put off these management actions, and then we give them an incentive after the fact, you know, for, okay, a dollar per acre,
gotcha,
rate, whatever it is, for the various practices. As far as on the wildlife areas, it's going to work differently. We're just going to directly pay for the management actions that are happening rather than, you know, because they're, it's not private landowners, right? Yeah. So they don't need the incentive, but they may not have the expertise or the time to do it with the staff on hand. And so we can just have somebody come in and do it on their behalf.
Yeah.
Now, like the refuge and managers, do they have to reach out to you to get some of these incentive monies? Or are you going to them to say, hey, you know, we could do X, Y, and Z at name refuge and go from there?
So we just had our first solicitation for wildlife areas just a couple months ago. And the way we did it is it was open for a month and they would apply, send me a spreadsheet. I reached out to all of the wildlife area managers to let them know, you know, that it was there and encourage them, hey, think about this parcel, think about this unit. But ultimately it's up to them to decide what they want to do and then submit those to me. Because it's a little trickier working on federal properties since we're a state agency, yeah. In this first year, we're only doing wildlife areas,
okay. Not
refuges. But we're working out some of those kinks, and next year our plan would be to include that for both wildlife areas and national wildlife refuges.
Is there an acre goal? What is your goal per year in terms of acres on the ground?
Well, I don't know if we'll achieve it. Central Valley Joint Venture's objective for upland habitat in the Sac Valley is like 54,000 acres.
Wow. Oh, wow.
So that's a lot. This year we got just over 4,500 acres, I think, in the private land incentives.
Is that mostly wheat fields and levees like you were talking
yep.
about?
Fallow ag, wheat, and, well, cereal grains, right? It could be triticale, right. Barley, oat, anything yep. like that. And then the rice levee ag corridor practice.
Okay.
Yeah. And then the enrollment, I got the numbers here somewhere, for the public lands, which will be implemented this fall, we got 3,200 acres. And that's a combination of sort of cereal grain plantings like we've been talking about, but also management of existing perennial grasses. 'Cause what we see is, and this happens both on private and public, you see a great restoration of grass, and it looks good for a couple, 5 years or something. And then without that regular management, mm-hmm. you get sort of invasive weed encroachment, and it can take over, you know, thistle, blackberry, pepperweed, mustard, a lot of things. And then over time, if those aren't managed against, then it just sort of takes over.
Yeah.
And so working with the public lands to sort of get on a better schedule of continuing to maintain those and manage them as grasses, we hope would have a meaningful impact.
So, I mean, I could vouch for it based on the fields I saw at like Upper Butte Basin this year.
Yeah.
I mean, they looked a lot better than in years past, and mm-hmm. they had quite a bit of nest success in those fields. So
Yes. Yeah. So, Jason, what part do we as CWA play in this whole nesting?
And played from the beginning.
So we kind of help manage the private lands side of this program, as well as do the nest monitoring for the private lands. And so basically, private landowners, i.e. farmers, can go on our website, find all the information on the programs, they can apply, and then we handle all the contracts with those farmers, monitoring those fields for nesting activity. We do two types of monitoring. We do breeding pair surveys in the morning, so we just stand in the corner of the field for 10 minutes every 2 weeks, first thing in the morning before sunrise, looking for and recording any kind of duck activity happening in and over the fields. And then we do full-blown nest monitoring with the quads and the ropes and the flags and the robel poles, taking nest vegetation measurements, candling the eggs, checking back on every nest every week. So like full-blown nest monitoring there. And then we also take care of the payments to those landowners at the end of the nesting season. And yeah, like CWA started the delayed wheat program, it was called back then, which is now the delayed cereal grain program. We also started the rice levy program. So we just kind of rolled those programs over into this NBHIP umbrella.
Gotcha. So now it's kind of all encompassing for everything. Yep. Makes it a little bit easier instead of having a bunch of different programs out there that all are kind of doing the same thing.
And we don't have to find the funding for it in-house. It's provided through the NBHIP program, which is
a huge help because
we were funding it for several years from our donors and stuff. So,
and we were instrumental in getting the assembly bill passed, correct?
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. I think both times, the initial legislation that created the program back in 2018, as well as the amendment in 2021 that identified the funding source, created the funding source.
Is this a forever type of program, or is there an end date on the bill where it's like, we're going to try this for 5 years and see where it goes?
In perpetuity.
Okay, cool.
Yep. So, I mean, anything can be changed.
Yeah.
You know, but it is set up so that it's a perpetual funding source.
Okay. Are they doing any studies for the actual bird numbers that you guys are seeing in the field to see if it has a positive or negative impact on the populations other than, you know, what we're doing?
Yeah. So like CWA is doing the nest monitoring on the private land stuff. USGS is doing nest monitoring on the public land stuff. And then we take all kinds of, I mean, this data entry form that we use is pretty intense. I mean, we record every single egg, the incubation stage, every single egg. If the nest gets depredated, you make a map of where all the eggshells were, how much the nest material was displaced. It's pretty intensive. And all this goes to USGS. They have a huge database. They've been nest monitoring in California for years, and they have a huge database of all these numbers. And so then they can go in and look at the effectiveness of this program as far as providing habitat and creating ducklings.
Interesting.
Yeah, so we really want to have good data on, you know, how these programs are having an impact, right? Yeah. We don't want to just go in and just do it and say,
I hope it goes well.
And so, but with that, you know, what that means is we got to spend a bunch of money on monitoring.
Mm-hmm.
And so on the front end, you know, we're going to be dedicating a lot of these NBHIP funds to monitoring, right? Through agreements with CWA and USGS, because we want a lot of the data on nesting waterfowl is pretty old in California. 30 years ago, McClandris did it. He was from, you know, CWA, Yaris, you know, that's a lot of the data. And then if it's newer, it's very regional. There's a ton of data from Sassoon, right?
Yeah.
But is that representative of the whole state? You know, you could argue probably not. And so we want to really get a new baseline of data when we start. So we've got, with USGS anyways, a 5-year agreement for them to do 4 years of intensive monitoring on the public lands and private lands with CWA, and then a full year of just analysis, right? And see, okay, what are we seeing? Which of these practices that we're rolling out are having the best sort of return on investment? And then we can use adaptive management, right? We can say, okay, well, the data says these are having a pretty good impact and these aren't, right? Well, mm-hmm. Let's stop doing these ones because they're just sort of wasting our money. And we want to make sure, right? The hunters are paying for this.
Yeah.
We want to make sure that they're getting a return on investment and we're not just throwing dollars away, you know, for no reason.
Yeah. You're talking about, you know, some incentives might not work as well as others. Have you seen any so far where it's like, hey, the rice levy program that seems just to be killing it, we're seeing a ton of birds there as opposed to this program, you know, they're not using what we're providing as much. Has something shown at least so far?
Well, what we have seen, I would say, you know, sort of bigger picture is from the monitoring is that the stuff we're monitoring on public lands has had way higher nest densities and nest success than the stuff we've seen on private lands. And that's already caused us to sort of be adaptive, right? When we came into this 2 years ago, we weren't planning, although we're allowed in Fish and Game Code to work on public lands, our intent was to mostly work with private landowners. But after the first 2 years of data, we're like, man, it's really showing there's a ton more nesting effort and nesting success on the public lands. Let's direct some of this dollars there so that we're making those even better.
Interesting. What's the thought there? I mean, is it because those lands have not been obviously farmed? There might be more water around on the landscape. I mean, what's your
Initial think? You know, summer water.
Yeah.
When they hold it, you know, we've seen some areas are better than others at maintaining that summer water. On the private land stuff, a lot of that is driven by rice water, which comes on later. And so you don't get that early season nesting. And where we're seeing, at least initially, they haven't crunched the data yet, but we're seeing a ton of early success on the wildlife areas. And so it may just be that's the only habitat there.
Yeah.
And sort of, you know, the value of having both, right? A mixture of good perennial grasses with summer water and these sort of seasonal ag, compatible ag crops that come on and offline, right? That can expand and contract. Yeah. I think that's going to be the ticket, but, you know, yet to be seen.
And is that just waterfowl? Is that also upland game, the higher densities in those areas on the public areas?
It's really hard to find pheasant nests on a quad. Yeah.
Did they find any on the public lands this year?
I think they may have found one.
Do they not flush like
they run?
Yeah. Oh, they run instead of flush.
Yeah.
That would make it hard trying to catch a running pheasant in the tall grass fields.
Yeah, even, I use my dog a lot now, and even then, I found two pheasant nests in 8 years of egg salvage drives.
Wow.
Really?
Yeah.
So they're definitely out there. So we are, one thing we're going to be adding is the use of ARUs, autonomous recording units. And I'm working with my counterpart in the Upland Game Program is Ian Dwight. He's the pheasant biologist at CDFW. And he's been rolling out this comprehensive sort of pilot for putting these ARUs out to detect pheasants. Once they're out there, right, they just record at whatever time interval you set them to do so. And it's the data he's getting is really amazing, you know, being able to detect pheasants, turkeys, ravens, turns out mallards and gadwall, right? Female mallards and male gadwall because they vocalize so much. And so we're trying to figure out if there's a way that we can use those to do more of a passive monitoring and get some sort of estimate of abundance, right? You're not going to get...
Is it just monitoring like, oh, there's a sound, there's a bird? Or is it like actually able to pick up like distance, different birds? I mean, what exactly is that data that he's getting through that?
So it doesn't have a distance. I mean, it has, you know, error bars on it. And as you get further out, it gets less and less accurate, right? And so when he's looking at the data, you know, he's saying, okay, it has to be this accurate for me to believe that when it says pheasant, it's pheasant. And they're truthing all that data. He's got a scientific aide that is working on that with him. It's the AI technology is awesome where it auto-identifies and you know, the more data you put into the system, the better it is. And so it's able to pick up pheasant, raven, mallard, gadwall, quail,
that's cool.
Turkey.
Yeah, I'd watched a YouTube video and they're using those to monitor gobbling in public hunting areas in the south and the southeast. And like you said, it's basically
I saw that.
The, you know, they tell it, hey, this is what a turkey sounds like. They hear it and the machine starts to learn.
Yep.
And they're seeing, you know, as the hunters came on, the gobbling density went down and they, it's like I said, it's passive listening, it's passive information, but it's great information to have that you wouldn't have otherwise. You're not going to go sit out there and just listen for days on end right. What's right. going on.
Right.
So if we could use that for waterfowl or pheasants, that'd be cool.
Yeah. The issue is, at least right now, it's not giving you abundance, right? It's not giving you a number. It's just sort of relative presence, right?
It can differentiate this mallard from that mallard.
Right. If there's 10 mallard calls, is it one mallard calling 10 times or is it 10 mallards calling once, you know? But Ian is one of the smartest people I know, so he'll figure it out. He'll there are ways, right, to sort of crunch those data.
We're trying to do the same thing with that breeding pair surveys in the morning because that's a lot less intensive. And part of the problem is with like the delayed wheat program is most farmers don't want us dragging ropes through their wheat field. And so how do we know how many birds are nesting in there? You really don't. So in every field that we do the full blown nest dragging in, we also do those morning surveys. And then in hopes in 4 or 5 years, you can crunch those numbers and see like, if you see X amount of birds over the field, you know, does that mean there's X amount of nests in the field? And so that way we can get a better idea of what's going on in fields that we can't monitor in. And then as the program scales up and we get, you know, thousands of acres enrolled, we can't go, we just don't have the manpower to go in there and search all those fields. So we can just spend a lot less time just doing the morning surveys and get a, you know,
kind of making your own little cheat sheet for it.
Hopefully get a decent idea that, you know, what's going on in the fields if the data works out, but. That's what about, to be determined.
Thermal imaging. You got a grant from Sitka to do that. I mean, is that something that's widely used or was that successful?
So we got a grant from Sitka. We bought like the top of the line DJI thermal imaging drone with the hopes of using it for nest searching in wheat fields. And we tested it out. We flew over a bunch of already marked nests that we had in fields in NBHIP. Just to see if we could find, just see the hen, you know, we know that she's there, hover over, use the thermal imaging. We could not see the hen. We did flush some hens off the nest, but we could not see her until she lifted off. We did find one nest haphazardly, but it was using, this drone's got like a giant spotlight and it kicks on when it lands. Well, we figured out how to turn it on and leave it on. And we just flew the field super low with that spotlight on and we saw a hen and she flushed.
That's got
to
drain the battery pretty quick,
though. Yeah. And so I mean, we're still going to keep trying it.
So what's the issue? The thermal signature isn't strong enough to get picked
like,
up?
Or? Yeah. So like the temperature of a hen's back is like a degree warmer than the ground temperature.
Oh,
so it just looks like any other warm spot. And you're flying over these fields and they're not perfect, right? And so you get little holes and patches in them. And any little dirt clod or whatever out there that's holding heat shows up bright red. And even though it's, you know, because it's so sensitive, it's only a degree or two warmer than the rest of the field. But it just blends the nests in so well that it's hard to see. Once she flushes off the nest shows up as a hot spot. But she's been insulating it so well that when she's sitting on it, you can't see it. And we're flying this at like 2 in the morning till sunrise when the ground temperature is the coldest. And we're still having troubles finding them.
I wonder if that's a natural, you know, predator deterrent thing for animals not being able to find them due to body temperature. I'd just throwing that out there randomly.
Yeah, I mean, it just makes sense that they're
like, you know, why?
Yeah,
why wouldn't you be warmer?
They, you know, they have only a certain amount of energy, and they're wasting a lot of it on these nests. Mm-hmm. And so, being as you know efficient as possible with insulating your nest is obviously advantageous. So it makes sense. I just didn't realize they were that good of insulators.
Yeah,
it's pretty impressive. So that's still to be determined on the effectiveness of that. But we did. Take it out to our Grizzly Ranch property because Robert Eddings reached out to us and said, hey, we got a ton of broods out here. You guys going to fly it for broods? And it is surprisingly effective for broods.
Oh, really?
Like, yeah, I just started flying it, just cruising around some of the summer units they had out there. And I was like, is that a brood? No. And then you finally see one, you're like, oh, yeah, it's pretty obvious. It picks them up really well. You can count the ducklings really easily. That the regular camera on that drone is so good. Like when we flew over some existing nests, during the daylight, like we number each egg so we can keep track of that. You can zoom in and read the numbers on the eggs.
Wow.
And so like you can zoom in on those ducklings and see exactly how old they are. Mallard to gadwall. I mean, it's pretty impressive.
This year?
Yeah, that was this year.
Yeah, there was a bunch out there.
Yeah, we found, we only flew for like an hour and found four or five broods out there.
How high are you flying that drone at?
It was like 150 feet.
Oh, and it can just zoom all the way down in.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. Yep.
How many nutria did you see?
None. The reason we didn't find more broods is because the nutria trappers were out there. And so all the broods were kind of in the vegetation and harder to find.
Oh, gotcha.
But yeah, no, there was, it's really effective for brood. So maybe that's something we could use it for in the future too. I mean, in evaluating flooded rice fields or brood units next to some of these NB hip fields, just doing kind of a bi-weekly, you know, survey with the drone to evaluate.
There's got to be some good use for it at some point.
I mean, they're doing all kinds of studies with it in the Prairie Pothole region.
Yeah, I was going to say, Kevin Rangelman, who's the new, he's the replacement for John Eady at UC Davis. he's just starting this fall, and he's had a couple students out in the Prairie Potholes doing brood surveys with drones and on like cinnamon teal and stuff. I mean, excuse me, blue wing teal. And they're like capturing them, putting bill saddles on, and marking them with bit tags. And then they can go out and they can use, they put a VHF telemetry on the drone so they can actually find the hen.
Then
they can zoom in and they're finding, it's like, you know, they're using that for like a correction factor. But it's like 90, 95%. Like they can find 90 or 95% of the broods in a wetland unit with this drone. It's
and
crazy.
They can read the nasal saddles with the camera.
Yep.
And then you can evaluate brood success, which has been really hard to do in the past. You know how many eggs hatched from that nest that you were monitoring. Right. But once they get out there and all you can do is walk around on foot, good luck seeing that brood and counting how many ducklings it has.
Yeah. Right.
Much, and then also know that it's the hen that you were monitoring.
Right, because if you see one day you see, you know, a hen with 8 ducklings and the next day you see a hen with 7 ducklings, is that the same brood and she lost one? Is it a different brood?
Yep.
You know, and it's like, how do you know? But with this being able to mark and recapture. So I think there's a ton of potential for that. And with Kevin coming on and going to have grad students out here, you know, I think that's something we'll probably be looking into in the future. Cause I think that's a key component that we haven't really looked at much in California. I mean, they've done a little bit down in Sassoon and stuff, but the brood survival is, you know, could be, you know, we have to figure out what is the pinch point, right? It's like, there are so many factors. There's, you know, is there nesting habitat? Are they going to nest in the habitat? Do they have summer water? Are the eggs going to hatch? Are they going to get predated? Once they hatch, you know, and how well do the brood survive? And it's like, which of those is the most limiting factor, right? Once we know that, it's like, okay, let's address that issue first.
Each one of those things you brought up has its own challenges in figuring out, you know, are they using the natural cover for nesting? And then it's like, once they each thing is different. So you have to have a drone for the broods and you have to have people on foot going and checking nesting. Like there's so many different things that you have to, if you can have all of it and have an effective way to do each one, you guys are going to have some great data.
Yeah. Well, and it's like you create all the habitat. If they don't use it, didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
You create the habitat, they nest, they all get predated, didn't work. They all hatch. Then they go to the summer water, they all get predated, didn't work.
Yeah.
You know, and
you're like, doing this
so
program.
It's like, which of these is the most important? Which
where in the chain is it breaking?
Exactly.
Yeah, because you could be doing nest monitoring for years and have great nest success. Right. And
you think like, you're killing it. You're doing great.
Yeah, but
all the birds die.
Yeah, right. And then the breeding population surveys come back and the mallard numbers are still declining. You're just scratching your head. Well, all the broods are dying.
Oh, that's so interesting. Yeah. Never thought
about
that way.
For the listener, What is the average brood survival to get to duck season? They're flying out of a clutch. What do we know up to this point?
Man, I don't know that number off the top of my head.
It varies regionally. It varies by species.
It's low. I mean, so I think a good nest success, you're looking at like 30%. And so if you go from that to brood survival, and I wish I knew this number off the top of my head, but even let's say it's 30% brood survival, you know, I think it is the first 2 weeks is the most critical period for brood survival. Once they get past that, the likelihood of them getting to fledge is pretty high. But transitioning from the nest to summer water is like one of the most treacherous things a duck will ever do in its life, right?
Yeah, I heard someone's like 1 in 20 eggs makes it to a duck, or it was something like yikes. That. Yeah, it's pretty low.
What's the most prevalent species that we have that nest in California or that use our programs?
Be mallards, gadwall, cinnamon teal.
Yep.
Be the biggest. Three. And then wood ducks, but those are in boxes.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So,
and then there are non game. I mean, you got pheasants, but then there's other species that nest out there a lot. You get turkeys, American bitterns.
Do you ever see something out there? You're like, what is this nest? And it ends up being like a scop or something just totally random.
No, occasional pintail nests. We did have some mysterious pintail ducklings show up at our egg salvage facility this year.
Really?
Yeah. The manager was like, I think they're pintail. You'll figure it out when you come and ban them. And I walk in the pen, I was like, yeah, those are pintail. I don't know. They must have came from a field we searched, but you know, when you're driving and flushing hens, it's hard to tell exactly what it is. A lot of times you're so focused on where she lifted off from that you're not like trying to identify the hen.
Because you just figure it's a mallard. Yeah.
And then it's brown duck flying away, you know. Yeah.
And then, it's a duck. All right, let's go get the eggs.
And to an untrained eye, a duck egg's a duck egg. You got to see like a pintail egg is very similar to like a gadwall egg or a mallard egg. And so unless you've seen a lot of both, you would just be like, oh, that's just kind of a goofy looking mallard nest. And you just throw them in the cartons and keep moving. So
they hatched out this year and you guys banded them?
I think five of them made it. We released five pintail ducklings.
You guys don't get any shovelers? I know they used to find a couple shoveler nests every once in a while.
Every once in a while, get a shoveler nest, a cinnamon teal nest here and there.
Yeah.
Always a handful of gadwall, but nothing too crazy.
I'd say, well, you say that, but probably most of the listeners have never seen a baby American bittern. That thing looks like a freaking pterodactyl. it is the weird, and they like hiss at you, and they lean back. They're weird looking creatures when they're babies. They got all this like hair sticking out.
Yeah. Brian had a funny description for them. I forget, like punk rockers or something. But
they got little mohawks. Yeah. And they're pretty wild.
That's funny.
Are you able to say how much money is available? Like how much money are hunters putting towards, you know, habitat on this specific program?
Yeah, I mean, we got a pretty good idea. I mean, it's going to change every year. So it's directly tied to stamp sales of the Upland Game Bird validation and the California Duck Stamp, right? So any viewer can go online to the CDFW website and find out how many validations were sold, multiply that by 10, right? So on average, it's about $2 million a year.
Nice.
That generates this program, that this program generates, right? So it's a good chunk of change, right?
Yeah, that's great.
And so we're able to dedicate quite a bit of money to habitat on the ground, right? And as we prioritize stuff, right, we can start to hold money aside if we want to do bigger projects, like do a big native grass restoration somewhere, right? Maybe it's going to cost $4 million, right? You can say, okay, let's start holding some aside and save up so that we can do this big project and make a big difference, right? Versus doing small stuff all over the place, or, you know, we just have to decide.
Yeah. One of the things we've been talking about within CWA is doing like a breeding hotspot. Mm-hmm. So buying a chunk or managing a chunk of for summer water and like a big chunk, a couple hundred acres, and then managing or enrolling the surrounding ag lands in this type of a program to promote nesting and just kind of
make it a giant duck factory. Right,
exactly. Awesome. Basically a lower Klamath, but in Sac Valley is what we'd like to see.
Waterfowl production area.
Yes, exactly.
Is what they're talking about.
That's cool.
Should be cool. They have like designated waterfowl production areas out in the prairies. And so it's like, is that something that could be replicated out here? So
this program could potentially purchase something like that potentially? Or is it like very restrictive on the funds?
I've never thought about that. We've not considered purchasing land. That's pretty costly. And so we have flexibility, which is what makes this program awesome, right? We can adapt and change this to do what is going to have the biggest sort of return on investment and help increase waterfowl numbers. I'm not sure that buying land is going to be really... $2 million isn't going to get you very much when you're talking about buying land. You know what I mean? And so we've been focused on annual management mm-hmm. practices, right? Or doing grass restorations on properties that already exist, right? And so I think that would probably be the better avenue, you know, for yeah. this program rather than purchasing land directly.
Well, it's good to hear this because I know we hear and we deal with a lot of hunters. Oh, how do I help or what do I need to do to help birds? It's like, even if you're not going out and shooting doves or turkeys, go buy your upland stamp. If you're right. not hunting waterfowl this year, go buy your California Duck Foundation. Like that money, as you're hearing right now, is going directly back to the nesting. So just because you don't know where your money might be spent, this is proof that you buy your validation and that extra $10 is going to go to the ducks and their nesting.
Yep. Yeah,
simple way to help.
Don't freak out when you look down at your license you right. just purchased and see your state duck stamp was $30. Because yeah, right. the money actually, contrary to popular belief, the money actually does go back to ducks. So
yeah, yeah. Yep. And I mean, the same applies, you know, for the federal duck stamp, right? That's funding habitat, some research, but mostly habitat projects. And that's continent wide, right? So they're doing stuff in the prairies. We get an allocation in California of that to do projects. And then the upland game stamp, you know, it's like $38 or something. I don't remember. Only 10 of that goes to NBHIP. The rest goes to the upland shop, right? And they're doing research. They're trying to do habitat projects on the ground, right? They're buying and planting pheasants for junior hunts and things like that, yeah. right? So it sucks when you look at, you know, you buy your stamps and it's a couple $100, but you know, that's all going to direct enhancements to try and improve yeah. conditions, you know, what populations and habitat conditions for hunters.
Definitely.
Can you speak to, you know, John Eady is retired or is in the process of retiring. Can you speak to kind of your involvement with him and kind of your UC Davis days? And I think there's a lot of listeners that might be like yourself that, you know, went a different route and then love waterfowl hunting. And what is the route to kind of get to where you are now and through your career in college?
Yeah. John Eady has definitely been a big part of my success in this career. You know, cause he was my advisor in both undergrad a little bit, but definitely as a master's, you know, he was my, advisor when I did my master's project. I think it's hard, right? Going back to school. But if you want to get into sort of waterfowl work, you can, you know, just start volunteering, working as a SIAID on a wildlife area or a national wildlife refuge and go that path. But if you want to get more into the sort of management and science and research, you know, going the school route and just being engaged. A lot of the guys I went to school with that didn't end up working in the field, I think what they did was, you know, they didn't waste their time, right? They wanted to party. They wanted to make money. And so they worked jobs, you know, or whatever. But I think the critical component is like volunteering while you're there, while you're in school, right? Mm-hmm. Because there's a million people who can know the same thing, you know. But if you can prove that you're willing to work hard, you're willing to learn, right? It becomes more about who you know rather than what you know. As long as you also know something, right? And so, you know, you can't be a complete dunce, but I don't know. I mean,
connections are huge,
right? And just being, you know, that yeah. way when they make the call and it's like, hey, how's this Jeff Smith guy? Who's Jeff Smith? You know, oh yeah, he was in one of my classes once and he sat in the back row, right? Versus, oh yeah, he was, you know, always there. Every time we had a volunteer deal, he was showing up, he was working extra hours, you know, not getting paid. It's like, oh yeah, that guy, he, you know, he busted his butt. I think you should hire him, you know, and then just sort of goes from there.
Yeah. Same applies to us. I mean, both with waterfowl programs and hunt programs. I mean, we would like to hire people who have had experience with our banding crews coming out volunteering. And you guys, you know, you have hunters who show up and they've been coming since they were a kid. They love duck hunting. They're kind. They're courteous.
Yeah, our interactions with them, and they might not even know it when they're yep. 13 years old, just how yep. they present themselves, end up hiring them 5 years later.
Yeah, and one thing I think the average person doesn't realize is how small the waterfowl community is.
Tiny.
Yeah. Both in California and nationally, right? And so it's like just getting in, if you're a CWA tech, right? And then, you know, somebody calls and you get a thumbs up, right? You can just continue to get more references And pretty soon it's like, you got connections in Mississippi, you got connections out here. All the Fed and state agencies work together pretty closely, you know, whereas the other side of that is you don't work that hard. You show up late all the time. And then once you got that black mark, everybody knows everybody. And so it can be hard to shake that. Yeah. You know what I mean?
I think all of us on this table have seen it both ways, where the person's like, probably not. And the other person's like, we need to hire this person.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There's been both sides of that coin where, you know, someone calls you or whatever. And
right.
What about this person? Never heard of the person. So they volunteered for you. I don't even know their name.
Right.
You
know? Yep. So. Yep.
Luke, are you a hunter yourself?
I am, yeah.
Born and raised hunting or later in life?
Yeah, I'm an adult start hunter. I didn't really start hunting until I was in college, actually. Started with some big game hunting.
You went big game first?
Well, small game, squirrels, rabbits, deer. Deer in California, if you don't know what you're doing, it's pretty hard. So it was mostly hiking around and shooting squirrels. But yeah, and then when I moved to Davis is when I started waterfowl hunting, because I was like, man, what is this YOLO place?
Yeah.
Why are there so many ducks?
Did you go to Davis for the waterfowl program, or was that an afterthought?
Once
you got into duck hunting?
I went for the wildlife, fish, and conservation biology as an undergrad. So I know I knew I wanted to do wildlife things.
You're a fisherman or just outdoors person?
Just outdoors guy. Okay. Yeah.
Just say, put me in the outdoors. I don't care what it is.
I mean, I grew up camping and fishing. And I mean, I hunted a little bit, you know, like BB guns and stuff as a kid. Mm-hmm. But my dad's not a hunter, not really a lot of hunters in the family. And then once I got into Davis, you know, I started sort of realizing where the job opportunities are and things like that. And so it was really more an opportunity, you know, a door opens and you walk into it.
Yeah.
I wasn't like a hardcore passionate waterfowl hunter my whole life, right? It was sort of, I was getting into waterfowl hunting. I loved waterfowl. And the opportunity was there. So I got into it. But I'd say I'm a pretty avid waterfowl hunter now. Hunt most of the wildlife areas and refuges. Do some big game hunting out of state, so I've dedicated a fair amount of time to it.
Especially we find, you know, the adult onset hunters, that they have a little bit of extra money, they have some time, and so if they do get that bit by that hunting bug, they kind of dive head first into it, and because, you know, they're free to do whatever they want, as opposed to a 12-year-old that got his license has to get driven around by his mom or dad or whoever takes him hunting.
Right.
Those adult onset hunters, like, you get it and you want to go, you go. Right. It's awesome. And
I enjoy the challenge of figuring it out. You know, I've had a couple rice blinds and it's fine. You know, it's fun, but you're sort of like, there's your hole. Enjoy your day. It's an opportunity.
Right?
And you know, when the weather's good, it can be great, but you know, even though you got to fight all the other guys that are out there at zero dark 30, I like hunting the public lands, you know, cause there's so much variation in habitat and hunt quality, and you know, you can really get after it and can be a one bird average and you can shoot a limit, you know? And so it's just being able to play the game and figure it out. There's something about me that likes to, likes to do that, you know?
No, it's very satisfying to be successful on public ground. It just feels different, right?
Yeah.
What was your first experience hunting YOLO like?
Oh man, it's just so intimidating.
Trials and tribulations.
So intimidating. I mean, you go out there and it's like 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, and you don't even know, you got a lottery number. You don't know if you can get on with that lottery number because nobody's told you what the cutoff is. And then you just wait out there. There's all these dudes in camo and it's just, it's intimidating. And then you go out and like trying to, you know, if you've never been on a wildlife area, it's like, where do you even start?
Yeah, I got this.
You know,
map.
And you like start hiking out and there's like dudes in the pond and you're like, how close am I allowed to be? And then you're like, you know, not shooting because you're worried that you're going to like blow up their hunt because they were there first. And so it's just the first year or two of hunting wildlife areas was, I say it's fun now. It was like stressful, trying to figure that out and, you know, not be the asshole out there.
Yeah. We talk about it a lot. Like we're all have hunted for a long time, but same thing, even going to a refuge, you know, as a younger, older man, it's intimidating. There's tons of people there. It's dark, you know, You don't want to mess anyone else's hunt up. You don't want to mess your own hunt up, you know, so it can be very intimidating.
And there's a lot of like unspoken rules.
Yeah.
Oh, awesome.
You know, and so it's just like all these things that there's no mentor to like teach you. You just got to sort of figure it out. Somebody yells at you, you're like, oh, I shouldn't have done that.
Yeah, that's good stuff.
But no, it's awesome. I love it. Have some fantastic hunts every year. So
good. Jason, what are we doing right now with, I know egg salvage isn't going on, but with the waterfowl programs, you can talk about what we did last month with some spotlighting and banding and what you guys are doing currently.
Yeah. So we spent, the last couple of weeks of July and almost the whole month of August up at, Tule Lake Klamath. CWA's got a contract with the state to ban mallards. So we were targeting mallards. We did run some swimming traps and Sump 1B up there, which weren't that, the molt was kind of early this year. And that's really where those swimming traps shine, is when you get molting adults that are flightless and kind of stranded in a certain wetland. And then you throw some bait out and they're pretty hungry and can't fly to go get food. So those swimming traps work really well, but the molt was early. So by the time we got up there, and we were delayed a little bit because there was some concerns with high path bird flu, in that area. So we got delayed. By the time I got up there, the molt was kind of coming to an end. So those swimming traps didn't work that well. We ran them for a couple weeks, caught 40 or 50 birds, ended up pulling them. And then we just helped out, two nights a week with the refuge crew, spotlighting. And that was extremely successful. There was a ton of ducklings up there, and that's really where the night lighting shines, because you get a lot of dumb little ducklings and you shine a light in their eyes. They just kind of stare towards the sky and you run up on them and scoop them up. So we caught, I haven't seen the final numbers yet, but I think it was somewhere between 6,000 and 7,000 birds in, I think, 8 nights.
Wow.
So
wow.
Almost 1,000.
That's busy.
Yeah. Almost 1,000 wow. birds a night. It was, the best I've ever seen it. We had 3 nights over 1,000. So
jeez,
it was pretty good. And then now we've transitioned to targeting pintail down here in the valley with rocket nets. We're off to a slow start. The places that wildlife areas are put in water are not areas that we've typically caught birds, although they're starting to get water in the good areas now. And by that, I mean, like, there's certain islands and roads and stuff that birds like to stand on where we set our nets to catch them. And so if you put water in spots that don't have room for our nets, it's obviously there's no way we can catch them with rocket nets. So yeah, we just put out a new net last night. Once we're done here, I'm going to run up and look at it and hopefully pop that sucker, get on the board, catch some pintail. The
first ones.
But, yep. And it's still early. I mean, it always starts out slow. We always get worried. And then come, like, by the time we wrap up right before duck season, it's like we're shooting nets every day and it's pretty easy. So.
Yeah, they stack in pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. And we haven't really gotten a huge push of birds yet. There's definitely a lot of pintail around, but not like there is, you know, October 15th. So
yeah. Yeah, I saw our first widgeon yesterday and then specks at our place. But yeah, the pintail have been there for weeks now.
Yeah.
But
a lot of teal too in the valley right now. Yep. I've been seeing.
Oh, nice.
Lots of mallards, lots of gadwall. Yeah.
With AI kind of ticking up, is there anything that the hunter should do to protect themselves or like their dog? And what should they do if they do find birds that look like they have AI? Call somebody, don't touch them.
The state Fish and Wildlife, you guys released like a protocol as far as like their recommendations on what to do. I mean, I would just say be cautious. If you shoot a bird and it looks sick, I wouldn't recommend eating it. And if you do, cook it well done. You can tell a lot of times if it has bird flu, look at its eyes. Their eyes will be blue.
Oh, that's
one of
creepy.
One of the side effects is that they go blind from, I forget the name, some kind of like corneal something. But they do go blind. So like if you see those snow geese flying around in circles.
I was gonna say, is that why they go in circles?
Yes, because they're blind and they can't see anything. That's got bird flu. So just be cautious around stuff like that. Wouldn't let your dog go run around picking up all the dead ones you find in a rice field. But overall, I'd say, I mean, I haven't heard of any issues. We've had this high path for 2 years now, and nobody in my circle of friends have had any issues with it. So,
yeah. And I mean, you know, I would also just be cautious of finding birds. You know, sometimes you'll find a wounded bird that's still alive, and
yeah, your dog dives into a tule patch on your walkout.
Oh, so many times your dog comes out with a dog. I mean, a bird, and you're just like, well, is this? Why did this die? It looks fresh, you know. And there's been times I've kept it with the AI and botulism stuff going on. I just wouldn't, sort of like you're saying.
When in doubt.
I wouldn't risk it, you know, and it feels bad. You're like, the bird looks good. Yeah. But, you know, and if you didn't see it flying and being normal, I'd be cautious. Yeah. But I'm sure there are protocols that we have, but it's probably going to be along the lines of like double bagging and PPE and all this stuff. Yeah. That's like probably not.
Call the SWAT team. Wearing different shoes in your plucking room, stuff like that. Like, who's going to follow that? Not really anybody. Right. So I would just use common sense, really, and I think you'll be just fine. I mean, I guide and handle a lot of dead birds, and then band all year long and handle a lot of live birds, and we're popping them and digging around in their cloaca, and pulling them out of crates where they're stacked on top of each other.
You're fine.
You're immune.
Yeah, probably had it a couple times. And no issues. So just use common sense, and I think everybody's all right.
You're gonna be the bubble boy. We're gonna be testing you out.
Yeah, I'll be patient zero or whatever.
That's good stuff. So Jason, how could local farming communities work with hatcheries to help support what you are doing and educate people on waterfowl and help conservation?
The biggest thing is just if they see, if they have a field and they think there might be some nesting birds in there, they're going to do some mowing or tillage or whatever, just give me a call. My contact info is all over CWA's website. And we can arrange to get out there and search the field or just swing by and pick up nests. I can bring you egg cartons beforehand. We just try to make it as convenient as possible for the farmers to get those eggs out of the field. So whatever they want to do, we can accommodate pretty much. For all the farmers that have been enrolled in the NBHIP program, spread the word. We've had nothing but good reviews about it, how easy it is. And so hopefully, the more the merrier. We want to build this program. So,
Luke, any big deadlines coming up that private landowners, farmers should be aware of to get their applications in?
We haven't set the date yet, but we'll do the solicitation for the private land stuff sometime probably late winter, I'd say. It's usually when we do it, December, January.
We'll do the the rice levy stuff in October.
Oh, rice levies. Yep.
And then because the way that program works is you can't touch your rice levies between December 1st and July 15th. And so if the farmers do want to mow, burn, re-ridge, do whatever to their rice levees, they have time to do it post-harvest before the ground gets too wet to do any work. So we try to do that in October.
Okay.
Yep.
Let them plan their season out.
Yeah. Another thing I think, for folks to think about, and this might be more on the wetland side of things, most duck clubs, they're managing their properties for seasonal irrigated wetlands, which is great. There's a ton of food production for wintering waterfowl. One thing that's pretty limiting is summer water, right?
Absolutely.
And that's going to have an impact on breeding waterfowl pretty heavily. And so, if there are opportunities on a club, to have more summer water. And when I say summer water, I'm talking about flooded from April 1st to August 1st, more or less. And I know you get tule growth, you get, weeds and different stuff you got to deal with. You got to go in and disc, but it can be tremendous, and you can see tons of broods when you have these on the landscape. So I'd encourage folks who have, private properties to think about that. That's not something we're incentivizing in NBHIP. Right now, there is Bird Returns, which is a program that the department funds and has run through the Nature Conservancy with Audubon and Point Blue. And there are funds, and I think CWA sends out notices when they're enrolling.
Presley programs and other
Presley program. Yeah. Presley isn't taking on new applications right now, but hopefully they get new funding soon and they can do another slug. But I think people undervalue or underappreciate how valuable having summer water is. And on the landscape, at scale, there's enough food in the winter for waterfowl. And so, if you're transitioning, you put, a 30-acre seasonal into summer water, it's not really going to change your bird use and bird patterns on your club, in my opinion. You know what I mean? And the food is there. They're feeding at night anyways, right? So when you're shooting in the daylight hours, they're not going to care if it was summer water or not, So encourage folks to think about that.
Those summer water units can be underrated too, as far as hunting goes. I mean, everybody thinks you got to have a beautiful field full of smart weed and water grass, but I've had a lot of really good hunts since units that have summer water.
Yep. Get lots some, of good tulies.
Get some thick tule potholes for birds to go in there when it's hot. Yeah, go in,
mow and disc some potholes afterwards, clean it up in like August, September, and reflood
it. Yeah, we had a funny story. I got an invite from a buddy opening Wednesday at an undisclosed North Valley refuge, and we had the last reservation. We go up, and there's one assigned pond left, and we're like, oh, we'll take that one. He's like, you don't want that. That had summer water, and it's full of tule. He's like, dude, we got no other option other than free roam. We'll just go jump in it. We don't care. Oh, okay. And he finally, after he told everybody else not to take that pond, which is historically a pretty good pond. They just had it in summer water. Yeah. We went out there at a great hunt. I think four of us killed like 30 birds. And, we came back, and then my girlfriend lottoed there like, couple shoot days later, and he like read her the right act. You ruined it, that pond. Everybody wants to go there now, and they don't shoot anything. It's like, you gotta go. So don't write that off as far as putting a pond in summer water. I mean, there's a lot. I mean, you could dry it out in August to September, disc it up, and then flood it late season. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of things you could do with those units and have good hunting in them as well. So,
yeah,
for sure. You guys got anything else to leave us with?
I don't think so. I appreciate everybody, you know, buying the stamps and supporting this program. You know, I think some exciting things. It's the first program, you know, that's looking at attacking declining waterfowl populations at scale across the whole state, you know. So I'm hopeful after a couple of years we start to see some, you know, meaningful improvements. So,
right on.
I'd like to thank all of our farmers that have been enrolling in these programs. We've got a handful of them that enroll every year religiously. Lumberg Farms, Bendon Farms, Korea, River Garden, Melissa and Joe Young, I mean, too many to name, that enroll year after year and are reliable. And that really helps keep this program going. And, you know, hopefully their neighbors are seeing fields and asking questions and they're going to start enrolling. So can't thank them enough for their support.
That's awesome. Well, keep doing the good work, fellas, and appreciate you guys coming on today.
Yeah. Thank
awesome.
You.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in this episode of Save It for the Blind podcast. You can listen on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or anywhere podcasts are found.